Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad Tuesday, in a speech to his parliament carried on state television, vowed to continue the fight against terrorism. He said the government has to fight a war imposed on it. He said the bloodshed will continue until it's ripped from its root. He vowed to liberate every inch of Syria from the hands of terrorists. Aided by forces from Russia and Iran, Syria has been battling opposition elements, including the Islamic State, and made gains, including the recapture in March of the ancient city Palmyra. He's also battling rebels back from the outside, including Turkey and the U.S. In Washington, U.S. spokesman Mark Toner called the tone of the speech vintage Assad.
There were no surprises in what he said, unfortunately. What would all of us have liked to see him recognize as his role in the carnage in Syria and to pledge to step aside and for that a political transition could take place? Sure. But he did not.
He appealed to Moscow and Tehran and those with influence on the Syrian leader to keep him from letting the Geneva peace process fall completely apart. The UN Refugee Agency now estimates 50,000 people have fled Boko Haram attacks in southeast Niger since Friday. The Sunni insurgency took the border town Bosso Friday in an attack said to have killed at least 26 soldiers from Niger and two from Nigeria. The UN agency said the capture of Bosso worsened the refugee situation in the Diffa region. The Kenyan government has banned further protests aimed at disbanding the country's electoral commission. The opposition is accused of being biased and corrupt. The security minister Tuesday cited the violence at rallies that killed at least two people in the town of Kisumu on Monday. Three others died in violence across the country last month. This is VOA News. President Obama and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi Tuesday highlighted the strong bonds between the two countries during a meeting at the White House. Mr. Obama said they're committed to signing the Paris Climate Change Agreement by year's end and thanked Mr. Modi for his serious commitment to clean energy.
How we can make sure that the climate financing that's necessary for India to be able to embark on the bold vision for solar energy and clean energy that Prime Minister Modi has laid out can be accomplished. And the agreements and memoranda that we reached, I think, reflect the seriousness with which both of us take the climate change issue.
Mr. Obama said the key priority is promoting economic prosperity, promoting jobs, investment, trade, and greater opportunities for both peoples. The leaders of the world's two biggest democracies also discussed security issues and strengthening global nuclear nonproliferation efforts. The European Union has unveiled plans to seek agreement with governments in Africa and the Middle East to persuade would-be migrants to remain where they are rather than seek jobs and safety in Europe in exchange for billions in aid. Frans Timmermans is the European Commission Vice President.
We propose to use a mix of positive and negative incentives to reward those third countries willing to cooperate effectively with us and to ensure that there are consequences for those who do not. This includes using our development and trade policies to create leverage. Member States will need to play their part and be ready to mirror this approach through their actions and resources.
Meanwhile, the European Court of Justice has ruled that EU countries cannot jail illegal immigrants simply for crossing borders inside the continent's 26-nation passport-free area known as the Schengen Zone. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sailed to victory in New Jersey's Democratic Party primary election Tuesday, one of six contests being held across the country prior to the two major parties' national nominating conventions. Clinton addressed supporters in Brooklyn, New York on this historic occasion.
Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
But her lone rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, says he's given no indication he's ready to quit the race for the party's presidential nomination. Nigeria's government Tuesday announced it's suspending military operations against militants attacking oil installations in the Niger Delta region and seeking to open peace talks with members of the Niger Delta Avengers militancy. Attacks on oil and gas pipelines have been a feature in the region for years, amid complaints of environmental damage and little benefit from the oil wealth generated. Those attacks have cut deeply into Nigeria's oil output. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International says Malawi's government is failing to stop the killing of albinos.
Only two cases of murder have resulted in convictions. So there is no deterrent effect. So one of the things we are calling on the Malawian government to do, particularly in rural districts, that there should be visible policing.
Salih Shetty is Secretary General of Amnesty International. Meanwhile, 50% of Malawi girls are married before age 18. Sudan and South Sudan take steps to strengthen bilateral relations, and Liberia's Special Corruption Task Force releases a persons of interest list.
The president had decided that all of the reports done by the DAC should be reviewed and closed. All of the questions that have been asked by the DAC that are unresolved should be resolved.
Councillor J. Fonati Kofa is chairman of Liberia's Special Corruption Task Force. A retired undefeated Liberian tennis champion will pay tribute to the late Muhammad Ali and will highlight the global impact of Muhammad Ali's legacy. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International has accused Malawi of a systematic failure in policing following the abduction and murder of several albino men, women, and children in recent months. It's believed their body parts are used in traditional rituals and medicines. Henry Richwell reports.
Amnesty says since November 2014 in Malawi, at least 18 people with albinism have been killed and at least 5 have been abducted and remain missing. Amnesty's Secretary General, Salil Shetty.
The issue of persons living with albinism and the discrimination against them is not new. But what we've picked up now is an alarming rise in the horrific practices of killings, abductions. Just in April this year, there have been 4 killings, including one baby.
One story typifies the horrific nature of the abductions. A woman by the name of Edna gave birth to twin albino boys. But earlier this year, a group of men broke into the family home and abducted one of her sons. She describes what happened. Edna says that when they grabbed the child by the head, she grabbed him by the legs, and the child was pulled in different directions as she tried to rescue him. Then one of the men who was outside issued instructions that they should just cut her arm. Then one of them fished out a big knife and cut her on her arm. She released the child and they took him. Amnesty says it believes the real number of murders and abductions is much higher because most of the crimes are never reported. It's believed the victims' bones are sold to practitioners of traditional medicine in the belief they will bring good luck and wealth. Around 10,000 Malawians live with albinism, a non-contagious genetic condition where the skin, hair, and eyes lack pigment. Campaigners say they face discrimination on a daily basis, and the increase in attacks has left them terrified. Amnesty accuses Malawian authorities of a systematic failure of policing.
Only 2 cases of murder have resulted in convictions. So there is no deterrent effect. So one of the things we are calling on the Malawian government to do, particularly in rural districts, that there should be visible policing.
Disputing Amnesty's findings, government spokesperson Patricia Kiliati told VOA that new measures to tackle the killings include a ban on traditional herbalists and stiffer sentences for the perpetrators.
We are making all those steps, making sure that we protect these persons with disabilities. There are those legislations which we are following, there are those stiff punishments which we are giving to the perpetrators. Well, they don't just wake up in the morning and start killing all those who've been caught killing persons with disabilities.
Amnesty says the measures don't go far enough to protect one of the country's most vulnerable communities. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Malawi has one of the world's highest rates of child marriage. Half of girls wed before their 18th birthday, and nearly 1 in 8 is married by 15. But since a new marriage law came into effect, one person has been on a mission to reverse that trend. Mariama Diallo reports.
She's known as Chief Kachindamoto, and she's managed to break up 850 marriages involving children under the age of 18 in Malawi. She says nothing makes her happier than seeing some of the former child brides back in school.
I tried my best to see these girls to be a lot in classes. So as you can see, indeed, I'm a happy chief.
A hereditary tribal chief, Kachindamoto left her longtime job as a secretary to lead 900,000 people in central Malawi's Dedza district 13 years ago. In a country where child marriage is deeply entrenched in society, the chief has had a difficult but not impossible task.
There's mother groups, and we have this community policing, child protection workers who are going, looking each and every house to follow these children.
Judith Kabango was married at 14 and has a four-year-old son. Kabango's marriage was annulled by Kachindamoto.
I wasted valuable time, but now I am in full-time learning and making a future for me and my child.
Stories like Kabango's are shared by countless girls in Malawi. Via Skype, Joyce Makandawire, Malawi's country coordinator for Rise Up, an umbrella organization that fights to empower girls worldwide, told us the story of Josephine.
At 15 years old, she has two children. This girl was married off at 12 years old. And the reason why, according to her, she said because of poverty, and because she lost her parents because of HIV and AIDS.
With their help, Josephine is now back in school. Following advocacy efforts by civil society and people like Makandawire and Chief Kachindamoto, the country's parliament last year passed a law raising the minimum marrying age to 18. But the new law may be in conflict with Malawi's constitution.
The constitution itself still allows for parental consent under the age of 18. So we see this in many countries where there's a tension between the letter of the law and the constitution saying one thing, a piece of national legislation saying another thing, and then customary or tribal law saying another thing altogether. And then the question is, how do these pieces fit together?
Thompson also says it's important to invest in dismantling the root causes of such marriages, including poverty and gender inequality. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
In Liberia, the Special Corruption Task Force appointed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has released a persons of interest list. It includes over 50 small businesses and individuals who will be screened to determine whether they had complied or not complied with past General Auditing Commission reports that are not currently being investigated by the Anti-Corruption Commission or prosecuted by the Ministry of Justice. But critics say listing people or businesses who an audit report shows might have owed the government as little as $2 is misdirected. They say the list should have included government officials and agencies accused of corruption but are not yet to be prosecuted. Task Force Chairman J. Fonati Kofa says President Sirleaf wants to make sure that all questions raised by past General Auditing Commission reports that are unresolved are resolved.
The president had decided that all of the reports done by the GAC should be reviewed and closed. All of the questions that have been asked by the GAC that are unresolved should be resolved. A lot of those reports are aging, and to try and speed up the process and begin to separate the issues from simple compliance issues, which can easily be resolved, to issues regarding impropriety and corruption, which would then be referred to the LACC for investigation. So what we're doing is just narrowing down the issue.
There are some concerns there. People say, why do you have somebody's name or a company's name for $2, for $13, for $32, $18, when in fact Liberians are expecting you to go after what they call the big fish?
I guess it's always sexy to go after the big fish, but these are simply compliance issues. This is the report that our staff people were able to do first because it was a little bit easier to compile. Before you put face up for compliance questions. You have to be satisfied. You have to refer to the GEC on questions. Some of those big fish items, if you will, probably a little bit more complicated. So before you list them, you need to understand what the issues are that the GEC had in listing it. I suspect as we go along, based on my review of all of the reports we have, they're probably going to get a little bit complicated and the amounts are going to increase.
So how many audits are you looking at? How many audit reports are you reviewing?
Yeah, so far we have about 40.
40 audits?
Yeah, so far. Remember, what we're doing is anything that is actively being investigated by the LACC or prosecuted by the Ministry of Justice, we do not touch. The ones we are looking at are ones who the statute of limitations may run out in the next year or so.
Are you also looking at, say, audits like the National Social Security, National Port Authority, LPRC, NOCAL, Information Ministry? Are you looking at these?
I look at all audit reports that are currently not being investigated, as I said. They are coming into the office from the GAC. Some of them were turned over to us by Justice, those ones that weren't being investigated. And I don't have an exhaustive list with me, but yes, I would imagine those would be among the piles that we look at.
Is it fair to say that Liberians should expect another list by this coming Monday?
It won't be another list. It will be an updated list. What has happened is, and people have been very cooperative, because the list went out yesterday, and already we have 30 persons calling in to try to come in and make their clarification. So once those people are dealt with, they will be removed off the list if there are no issues of impropriety. And then the list will continuously be updated. If there are issues of impropriety, we put them on what we call a target list, and then we give a LACC referral.
Councillor Jay Fonatikofa is chairman of the Special Corruption Task Force. He was speaking with me from Liberia's capital, Monrovia. Today is Wednesday, June 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Sudan and South Sudan have taken steps to strengthen their bilateral ties more than a month after Khartoum once again accused Juba of supporting rebels who are fighting to topple President Omar al-Bashir's government. Three South Sudanese ministers returned from Khartoum this week after signing several security agreements. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Defense Minister Kwal Manyang Juk, Foreign Affairs Minister Deng Alor, and Interior Minister Alfred Ladugore traveled to Khartoum last Friday to meet with their counterparts and President Omar Hassan al-Bashir in a bid to iron out their differences. Alor told journalists in Juba upon arriving back from Khartoum that the two sides signed an agreement on security matters aimed at minimizing insecurity along the borders between the two countries.
The center line, demilitarized zone, and the crossing corridors. We have signed an agreement on those three issues. We are discussing bilateral issues. We are discussing the problems between the two countries. We are also discussing how to overcome those problems. We have agreed to open a new page because we need to resolve all our problems with the Sudan.
Alor says the agreement also addresses economic challenges facing both countries as a result of lack of cooperation as well as the drop in the demand for oil. Juk calls the trip by the transitional government of national unity to Khartoum as the start of a new page in relations between South Sudan and Sudan.
We discuss on how we implement the peace in the area, how do we work for the peace in the area. And we came out with a very fruitful meeting, and it's a turning point. And had things been like this, there would not have been any problem between the South and the Sudan.
In recent years, Juba and Khartoum have repeatedly accused each other of supporting rebels fighting against their two respective governments. Juk says the visit was aimed at repairing those damaged relations.
There's hope that relations between Sudan and South Sudan will improve. Example, you have many of the South Sudanese who have gone to Sudan, very many of them, over 400,000. We have also many of the Sudanese people who are in South Sudan in the business sector, and we need to benefit from Sudan in the same way they want also to benefit from us.
Juk says under the recently signed agreement, Juba and Khartoum will withdraw their armies from disputed border areas. The two countries are yet to demarcate the common border after South Sudan separated from Sudan in 2011. Khartoum shut down its border with the South Sudan in January, blocking bilateral trade between the two countries. Juk says both governments must continue to work together to address many problems, including the economic crisis in the two countries. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Muhammad Ali was not only the world boxing heavyweight champion, but also was known for his activism outside the ring. Ali, who was born Cassius Clay, died last week at age 74. He will be remembered internationally, with many dignitaries expected at his funeral on Friday. VOA's Caroline Presutti explains why this sports icon's popularity extended far beyond the boundaries of the United States.
Before a fight, Muhammad Ali could be a braggart.
And the world will bow and admit that I am the greatest of all times.
During the fight, he could be a showman. Colorful and controversial, he took his boxing global. In Africa for his rumble in the jungle with fellow American George Foreman. In the Philippines for the Thrilla in Manila against Joe Frazier.
When I was a child in Afghanistan, I heard about him and everybody wanted to be Ali in his school.
Muhammad Ali had 56 wins and 5 losses, but not everyone knows of his diplomatic record outside the ring. In 1985, Ali flew to Lebanon, but failed to get hostages freed from a hijacking. 5 years later, during the Gulf War, he met with Iraq's Saddam Hussein and brought 15 American hostages home. Tributes keep pouring in to Ali's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, where Imam Zaid Shakir will lead a prayer and memorial service. He says Ali became an international name after he refused a fight in the Vietnam War and was stripped of his heavyweight title. Imam Shakir spoke via Skype.
He could have the cars and the homes and the yachts and the money and the limelight, and he gave all of that up to take a principled stand in defense of the weak and downtrodden.
Attending Friday's funeral, several heads of state, including Jordan's King Abdullah and Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. No surprise to the owner of this boutique.
He was very popular, and me and my age, we all grew up with him. We watch his games and we know him very well.
No one knows that better than Ali's daughter, Layla.
This man transcends everything there is, and everybody just loves him, you know. So there isn't anybody else like him. I don't think there ever will be.
Muhammad Ali leaves a legacy extending across the globe. And this quote of his speaks to all of us. Live every day as if it were your last, because someday you're going to be right. Ali's someday was last Friday. Caroline Presutti, VOA News, Washington.
I'm the greatest, and I'm knocking out all bones. And if you get too small, I'll knock you out.
As the world mourns the death of U.S. world heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali, a retired undefeated tennis champion of Liberia has written a poem in tribute to Ali. Here is Dr. Tobana Tipote, former Minister of Planning and Economic Affairs of Liberia and candidate for the 2017 presidential elections in Liberia, with the poem, The Right to Be.
The Right to Be, a poem in memory of Muhammad Ali, the greatest boxer. Born out of clay, in the light of day, with no relations to Cassius of Rome, no place to call my home, now I'm grown up, but fed up with the slave system forced on me by them, bent on bending my dignity, bent on crushing my integrity, blocking the doors of useful opportunity, spreading injustice with all impunity, determination being my calling through my parental upbringing, I opened the boxing door, working hard from the floor to become the greatest boxer of all, standing tall to no one fall. Moving like a fly, on my determination rely, stinging like a bee, flexing my right to be. From the rumble in the jungle to the cellar in Manila, I remain the greatest, surviving all kinds of tests. Even the test on the Vietnam War that seemed not to thaw, when the biggest democracy, with its blend of hypocrisy. Use the money to test my integrity. Again, I survive with dignity. Through the grace of Allah, the grace of God, without any demeaning order, because I am the greatest, passing all kinds of tests, spreading love and justice for all, for my dignity to stand tall. Yes, I am Muhammad Ali, exercising my right to be.
That was Dr. Tobana T. Patel, retired undefeated tennis champion of Liberia and former Minister of Planning and Economic Affairs of Liberia. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Marco Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Kenyan world junior champion Margaret Wambui ran a lifetime best of 1 minute and 57.52 seconds to triumph in women's 800 meters at the Montreal International Meet in France on Tuesday. Fellow Kenyan Emily Cheriot was runner-up in 2 minutes and 0.14 seconds. Kenyan Nicholas Kipkoech pipped compatriot Jonathan Kitilit in a scintillating sprint for the finish line in men's 800 meters. Kipkoech clocked 1 minute and 43.83 seconds to Kitilit's 1 minute and 43.89 seconds. Gotye Tom Gebreselassie led Holtamesh Tesfai, Bizunesh Getasheu, and Bituka Nalemu in a 1-2-3-4 Ethiopian victory in women's 5,000 meters. Ivory Coast's Winfred Kofi clocked 10.10 seconds to place second in men's 100 meters as Ronald Musagala of Uganda ran 3 minutes and 36.34 seconds to place second in 1,500 meters ahead of Ethiopian Gebre Medin Mekonnen. Turning to football, the Netherlands outplayed visitors South Africa 2-0 in a women's international encounter in Valwijk, some 100 kilometers south of Amsterdam on Tuesday. Earlier on in a first engagement, Netherlands pipped South Africa 1-0. South Africa is gearing up for the women's football contest at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Meanwhile, Madagascar is the most improved men's national football team in the world, while Rwanda has slipped by the widest margin in the world, according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland. Positioned 32nd, Algeria's Desert Fox remains Africa's highest-ranked team. African champions Ivory Coast are 36th and are immediately followed by Ghana's Black Stars. Senegal is 41st, Egypt 45th, Tunisia 47th, Cape Verde Islands is 49th, the Democratic Republic of Congo is 52nd, Guinea 55th, and Cameroon 58th. Finally, in boxing, Ghana's Richard Comey has secured a slot to challenge Robert Easter Jr. of the United States of America for the IBF lightweight title. The two are set to clash at a date and venue to be confirmed by the end of the month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, June 8th.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa. May I please use your medium to call on the federal government of Nigeria not to scrap the Nigeria Youth Service Corps. This corps was introduced in 1972 to further strengthen the national integration that took place in 1914. The service has also brought about a lot of opportunities to young graduates in Nigeria since 1972. Albert Alagbo, Probably to Katura's Bachelor Award in a Balikuluka government area of Cross-River State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And that is it for this Wednesday, June 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.